Well, today, Secretary of State John Kerry visited Syrian refugees in Jordan at a camp that's now home to more than 100,000 refugees fleeing the fighting in Syria. NPR's Deborah Amos just returned from the region. You probably heard her reports from that same refugee camp. We've asked her to open her reporter's notebook, or maybe it's an iPad at this point. Deborah, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks. And it's actually a smartphone.
Really? I wondered.
Yes. I am working in a revolution that is pretty much run by social media. And so I've had to learn new tricks to keep up with both sides who use YouTube, iPhones, cameras to report the conflict. And so it is essential that we keep up with technology.
Well, and because of that, we've been hearing your reporting, so let's get to the heart of it. What is happening in Syria? The most recent reporting had the Syrian government gaining the upper hand with the help of Hezbollah, the militant group from Lebanon. Where are we now?
I could tell you plenty of details. I could tell you that the rebels had besieged the government area in Aleppo, Syria's largest and most important town. I could tell you that rebels have moved further into regime-controlled places in the southern province of Deraa. And as you rightly point out, there has been a shift towards the regime as Hezbollah and the Iranians and the Russians back the regime much harder than they have in the past. But the broad outline, I think, is the most important thing to know. We are in a stalemate, a brutal and terrible stalemate, where neither side is in a mood to come to any negotiating table. And so what you have is 5,000 deaths a month, 6,000 refugees a month, and it is a brutal, brutal war of attrition.
Well, and what happened to some of the debates over that war? The Syrian rebels said they needed heavier weapons. In June, the White House said it would give direct military aid to Syrian rebel forces. What happened?
Well, two things that have been interesting. There has been a series of reporting out of Washington that says, you know, the Obama administration made the decision to at least give light arms to the rebels. The British government had made that same decision. Both governments have pulled back. We saw reporting just last week that said that there were congressional committees that had doubts that any arming of the rebels would risk falling into the hands of militants. The British military is giving the same advice to David Cameron. Now, the main rebel force that Western powers are backing, Salim Idris, said he had been betrayed by the British. They are offering him instead training in Jordan. Training in Jordan has been going on for some time. There have been Western intelligence agencies, the Turks, there in an operations room. They have been training the rebels. But what the rebels say is we cannot change the dynamics on the battlefield unless we are properly armed.
Yeah. There was a death recently of a young rebel who was something of a citizen journalist. He was making all sorts of videos, posting them on YouTube with these poignant pleas for help. His fiancée was killed, shot and killed in fighting inadvertently by the very rebel forces that he was supporting. And then he was killed. That seems so symbolic. This was just last week. But of this, almost the death of the voice of the original rebel fighters. Do you see that happening? You said stalemate, but is one side pulling ahead of the other?
No side is pulling ahead of the other. And that is what's so difficult for people who are not in the fight. Those revolutionary, young, idealistic people who began this revolt, they are out of the equation now. Most of them, the ones who survived, have left the country. There are very few of them who are left inside the country. And that, I think, is the most difficult thing to grapple with, that early idealism. Those people will tell you, maybe this was all a terrible mistake because no one can see an end in sight. And the numbers are very bracing. I was just recently in a meeting in Beirut where a Lebanese economist said if the fighting stopped right now, it would take 15 years for Syria to get back to where it was in 2010.
Mm, you said quite a lot just then that the original rebels perhaps are all gone, that some people are thinking this was a mistake. Who's replaced those rebels? Is it true the Assad regime says these are foreign fighters who've come in?
I think the numbers, when you look at experts who have been doing the counting, will tell you that they are quite low. Those foreign fighters do have quite an impact. In the past couple of days, they have challenged the Free Syrian Army, the more moderate group within the rebels, in fact, assassinating a commander and saying that they would assassinate the rest of them. There is a challenge internally with the rebels, those who are more moderate Syrians, who have a vision for the kind of country that they are fighting for, and radical Islamists who have come into the country.
You mentioned rebels getting out of the country. Others are as well. Tell us about the refugee crisis.
Often it is said that one refugee is a tragedy and two is just a statistic. It's very hard to really comprehend how big a tragedy this is. I'll give you a couple of statistics that may help. September this year, in Lebanon, there will be more Syrians in school in Lebanon than there will be Lebanese children. And these are children who have become refugees, have left their country, missed out on things like immunization. State institutions have collapsed inside Syria. We're already seeing a measles epidemic in some neighborhoods in Lebanon where Syrian refugee children have come because they haven't been immunized. In Jordan, a refugee camp called Zatari, 120,000 people live there. It is just about a year old. It is now the fourth largest city in the country. It is hard to overstate how big this is.
Well, and as we said, that's where Secretary of State John Kerry is today. That's NPR's international correspondent Deb Amos, just back from the region that she's been talking about as she covers the war in Syria and the refugee crisis that it's caused. She's giving us her insights, her reporter notebook. When we come back, what is the international community doing? That's after a break.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and we're taking a deeper look at the civil war in Syria, pushed off your radar maybe by Egypt, Edward Snowden, and maybe its own very intractable nature, a three-year war with no end in sight. But today, a UN envoy warned that both sides in the conflict are committing grave atrocities against children, and as we've been hearing, children are also being forced into refugee camps. And a recent UN report said refugees are spending, on average, 17 years in camps. NPR international correspondent Deb Amos is just back from the region. She's opening her reporter's notebook. And Deb, you know, that statistic made us wonder, what is the international community, countries like the U.S., Britain, Russia, doing, if anything, to help deal with the refugee crisis that's being created by the Syrian war?
Both the U.S. and the British government are pulling back from the notion of arming the rebels. Now, American policy, U.S. policy, has been very clear. They don't want the rebels to win, but they want them to have some dynamic on the battlefield to force the Assad regime into a negotiating position. That means that you somehow have to make sure that the rebels have some strength so that there is some balance on the battlefield, because right now the Syrian government is really quite strong. They've taken most of the territory in the middle of the country. They're moving both south and north. So if that part of your policy has collapsed, if you have decided that you are not going to arm the rebels, they are going to lose. They are going to lose territory in the south and in the north, and that means a larger refugee crisis. I have not seen a policy that articulates what Plan B is, how you get the international community to bring in enough funds so that this crisis can be dealt with in some manageable way. You are beginning to swamp not only Lebanon, but Turkey, Jordan, and Iraq. And what you have is regional instability. It feels like all of these countries are inching towards the abyss because of the Syrian civil war.
So you're saying that it's not even up to the Syrians anymore, that Russia, the U.S., the larger powers circling these countries are going to have to be the ones to figure it out. How do you see that playing out?
We've seen this before in Afghanistan. We've seen it in the Balkans. We've seen it in Lebanon. This is a place where the major powers have interests. It's a place that has oil. It is a place that blows up in your face. Israel is there. Egypt is one of the most important allies of the United States. This is a part of the world where the great powers have interests. And so it will take the great powers to sort this out. Of course, they all have their proxies in the region, but this is not only a regional war, it is a proxy war. You see the conflict between the United States and Russia. You see the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. All of that is playing out in Syria. And so all of those players will have a say in how Syria is settled.
You've covered the Middle East for years. And it must be hard for you to get across what makes this different. Can you?
I think the reason that it is different, and I often use a movie to explain why it's different. And for anyone who has seen Lawrence of Arabia, the last scene, I often say this is Syria is in the Lawrence moment again. The last scene has Lawrence in, actually, the parliament in Damascus. And Syrians are fighting among themselves, and Lawrence watches them fighting and leaves in disgust because what he knows is that no matter what they decide, it is out of their hands. This is a crisis that has to be solved by the major powers, as it did in the time that Lawrence describes, and that is 1919, the First World War. We are talking about, in Syria, challenging 100 years of history, borders that were drawn, alliances that were made, a series of historical steps that have been taken over the last 100 years. All of them are being challenged. That is why Syria is so different, and that is why it is so difficult to solve, because now you have not just a civil war in Syria, but you have Lebanon involved, you have Syria involved, you have Iraq involved. All of these three countries have some of the same issues that Syria does. To solve one, you will have to solve all three of them, and that is a major undertaking.
Is it all the longtime Shia-Sunni divide? Is that what you're saying?
Historically, that comes and goes. It is not just Sunni-Shia. It is about minorities and majorities. Mm. That really is what the issue is. And some of those borders that were drawn more than 100 years ago made up countries that had imbalances in majorities and minorities. Syria is a mosaic. It is, however, predominantly a Sunni country that has been ruled by minorities. Alawites, Christians, Kurds, Druze. It is the reverse in some ways of Iraq, where you have a majority Shia population ruled by Sunnis. That is the issue that has to be dealt with. We have our own problems with minorities and majorities in this country, and it took us a long time to sort it out. And the Middle East is not even close to where we are.
This is uppermost in your mind, getting across this information. But I want to ask you something, if you don't mind. You and NPR's Kelly McEvers just received the prestigious George Foster Peabody Award for your reporting. But here you are in a region of the world fraught with issues for women, and we're seeing so many women in war zones. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, another one, done terrific work. Why do you think that is happening?
I started to see it happen 20 years ago, in particular in the Middle East, because we actually have more access. We are able to see, in conservative societies, we're able to interview women and men. Our male counterparts had a tougher time with that than we did. And by the time of the first Gulf War in 1991, the press corps was 50-50. Now, I would argue, the gender gap is really more in women's favor. It has to do with men who have professional wives who can't, you know, travel abroad and base themselves in international spots. Women have migrated. It's not just National Public Radio. The New York Times correspondent in Beirut is a woman. The Washington Post correspondent is a woman. Very good war correspondents. Both of them. Time Magazine has an excellent woman correspondent. I think we are less threatening in the field. I think that is part of it. But I think that this has been a process that's been going on for almost 20 years.
Well, and you wouldn't say this, but I will. I'm sure it also has something to do with the fiber of the women who have come along and are doing this good work. Deb Amos, one of them, NPR's international correspondent covering the Middle East. Thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Bicon, providing the Bicon Dental Implant System, a comprehensive short dental implant solution since 1985. Details at Bicon.com. And Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain. At Lumosity.com.